it really it gets into the background of where did this disease come from. Oh, we're told, well, we're not sure. It's been around for a long time. Came from a monkey who bit an individual, or somebody ate monkey meat, and that's how it all started. But there always have been those who've suggested, no, there's too much evidence that suggests that this was a disease was created for biological warfare against humanity, and because there is a population control agenda, and they really do want to kill off millions and millions and millions of people. In fact, if you've read the writings of Jacques Cousteau, certainly Genesco Courier, November of 1991, we have the document if you'd like to see it. Jacques Cousteau talks about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. 350,000 people a day. Of course, too many people. He is simply a piker. They're those people who want to eliminate over 90% of the world's population. And if you doubt that, you should go, as I have, to the Elbert in Georgia, and there, standing in the shadow of the Georgia Guidestones, the American counterpart of the British Stonehenge, which is an occult monument, and so is the one in Elbert in Georgia. Nobody knows who the man was who put the money up for it. Nobody knows the secret society that he claims he represented, but there, point number one in the Ten Commandments, written in eight different languages, is the statement, maintain humanity at 500 million in constant balance with nature. And, of course, that would mean with over 6 billion people in the world that have to kill off over 90% of the world population. There really are people who look at the world differently than you and I. One of the hardest things in the world to acknowledge is that this really is possible. But the reality is only you have to look and see what the Germans did to the Jews and the Gypsies and the disabled, and what the Russians did to 60 million people in their population, and what the Chinese did. And why, I dare say there's probably not one in 1,000 Americans who knows about the Great Hunger between 1958 and 1962 in China, where the Chinese communist government, which we had put in power, systematically starved to death over 40 million people. Now, of course, some people will say it's only 30 million, but I believe the figures are close to between 41 and 44 million people. And, of course, those are based upon the Chinese communist figures in a book written called The Mother's Ordeal, and certainly written by a gentleman that I personally know who has spent a great deal of time in China. How could you cover up the murder of 40 million people, or even 30 million people between 58 and 62? And well, very simply, we have freedom of the press in America. That means when you control the press, you have the freedom to repress and suppress whatever you want to. And that's how you control the reality of the American people. Well, our friend this evening is going to be Don Scott, our guest this evening, and he's going to tell you about the origin of the AIDS virus, a very effective, well, means of population control, not as effective as I think they'd like, but a deadly, deadly new disease. Don, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure to talk with you again, Dr. Stan.
Well, we're going to be trying to pick up where we left off last time, with the gentleman who went over to New Guinea and was found this new disease called Kuru. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, Don, you picked the story up.
Yes, well, you're talking about Dr. Carlton Gazdusek, who turned up in New Guinea and in the 1950s, and he discovered a disease that was raging among the four tribe of New Guinea. He called the disease Kuru, as you mentioned, K-U-R-U, which in the language of the four people means trembling or shaking or shivering. And the disease was killing the people off so fast. If it had been around for very long, there wouldn't have been very many people there or any people there. But anyway, Gazdusek turned up there. And it turned out he had been kind of pointed in that direction. Now, he's very, very ambiguous about how he actually got to New Guinea. He went to Australia where he met Frank Burnett. Now, Frank Burnett was an Australian scientist who was knighted by the king of the empire for his work in science, and but he was known especially to a lot of people as a great friend of Henry Kissinger. Now, that should ring a blind bells with anybody who knows Mr. Kissinger. And with Frank Burnett, Gajdusek discussed a number of illnesses that were common among the people of the Indonesian islands and so on. And after a period of time with Frank Burnett, Gajdusek headed over to New Guinea, where he came upon this disease, Kuru, and he began to study it.
Well, of course, he must have had a fair amount of money. Somebody had to be putting up the money. He describes about 100 people who were there, part of his entourage. And, you know, you don't get 100 people and carriers and all these things without a lot of money behind you. You don't go traveling all over the world unless somebody's putting up the money. And he would never really tell you who did put up the money, would he? Would you talk
to
him?
Yes. I had interviewed him by radio, by telephone, pardon me. And I said to him, where did you get the money? And he said, I paid my own way. And I said, oh, come on, because I had read his diaries, and in the diaries he did mention what you mentioned just now. On the one occasion, he was traveling in New Guinea with 100 people. He had other scientists with him, and he had all kinds of equipment, and he had gifts for the people whose relatives had died of Kuru.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Don Scott, who's written a book, AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief. And it really is a crime beyond belief. How do we know that suddenly this was man-made? Well, very, very simply, because there are 8 different subtypes of this disease that all occurred spontaneously at the same time. Now, do you really believe that? There's HIV-1, HIV-2, HIV-1 types O and M. Under the M, there's A, B, C, D, E, and F subtypes. Why would they be in different parts of the world, all occur suddenly at one time, and they've maintained their differences? They've never evolved beyond those subtypes. They may evolve within the subtype, but never definitely. Where would 8 different diseases come from all at one time? Well, you pick up the story. And, of course, Dr. Don Scott's talking about a man named Gajdusek. And during the 1950s, he was over there in New Guinea and looking for a disease. Now, of course, remember the last time we had Don on, Don talked about a doctor, a Japanese military officer named Ishishiro. And Ishishiro, of course, had actually experimented with new diseases and had created some horrible diseases, and he'd used American soldiers to experiment on, but of course he was never punished for killing Americans and torturing Americans to death with these deadly diseases, because he had secrets, and one of them was the fact that he had sent people to New Guinea to experiment on some of the natives there. And so here then, shortly after the end of the Second World War, Dr. Gajdusek is in New Guinea, and he's trying to search out this strange disease, a progressive neurological disease or brain disease. And of course, Don's suggestion is he was really sent over there by some sort of a government agency. After all, you don't pay your own way to New Guinea and have 100 people in your entourage, according to his own diary. So pick up the story, Don.
Yes, well, as I mentioned, Gajdusek was there in New Guinea with all of these gifts that he was giving to the relatives of the dead Kuru victims, and he was giving them gifts because he wanted to take the bodies as cadavers and take out the brains, and he was shipping the brains to scientists in various parts of the world. Scientists were a number of Nazi links. How he ever got in touch with them all is hard to imagine, but there was a network behind him. And he was traveling out with this group of 100 people, and autopsying the dead Kuru victims, and he was violently angry when I suggested that he was under the pay of the U.S. government. We decided, first of all, that we would try to figure out where this disease among the Kuru might have come from, and we did some research into that, and it's very, very remote to find the details, but it turns out that the first case of Kuru was noticed someplace around 1952. What? Well, just 1952. How did it get such a hold on the four Indian tribe taking so many lives in 1952? Then we discovered that in that area, 10 years before, there had been the invasion by the Japanese military, along with a unit controlled by Ishishiro, the Japanese general you mentioned. Now, Ishishiro was a medical doctor, and he was working on biological weapons for the Japanese, ways and means of killing people using natural disease agents rather than using guns and bombs and so on. And we learned that in that area they had established what they call a water purification plant on the north coast of New Guinea. And their water purification plants, that was a euphemism for a biological research station. And what were they researching? Well, we couldn't find out. And why couldn't we find out? Well, we couldn't find out because Ishishiro, when he was captured by the Americans at the end of the war, he reached a deal with General MacArthur. Oh, my heavens, General MacArthur, the American Caesar, who had done so much good work in putting down this fascist nation that had attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor. It turned out Ishishiro reached an agreement with MacArthur that he would tell what they were doing in New Guinea.
Don, please speak up. You're fading just a little bit. Go right ahead.
If MacArthur would spare his life. So MacArthur agreed to spare his life. In fact, he hired him. He put him on the American taxpayers' payroll practically for the rest of his life.
But, of course, what's so horrible is that this is the man who had actually experimented on a number of American helpless prisoners of war and killed them. But nobody seemed to be concerned about his crimes as long as he, of course, gave the secrets of what he had discovered in his macabre medical experiments.
Yes, the American people were dreadfully concerned, it seems, but that's understandable because all of this was really going on in secret. They could find out if they really wanted to find out, and there were people who actually learned of the Kuru disease because Gazdusek was not only a researcher into biological weapons, it turned out. He was, naturally, also a very well-trained, skilled scientist. And he wrote many, many scientific papers about Kuru, and there were bits and pieces in those papers which gave away a lot of the suggestion that he knew something about Kuru before he even got there. And the only place he could have learned it was from his friend Spadell at the American Military Hospital, Walter Reed Hospital in the United States. And it was Spadell, it turned out, who had sent Gazdusek off to Australia to meet Frank Burnett. Well, anyway, Gazdusek gets down there, finds all these people dying of this disease that had come into being about 1952, and then we realized that the disease was called lentivirus disease. Lenta means slow, and that it would take at least 10 years if somebody became infected for the disease to show if they were just casually infected. And that would take you back to 1942 when the Japanese were in that area with their water purification plant. And so we posed this question to Gastrusek, that he was there doing research for the military. He was very angry about it, but he was very courteous in the sense that he said, "Well, I'll tell you what I'll do, Scott," he said. "I'll send you a package of my research material, and you can make of it what you want, and if you can find any links to the military, you're welcome to it." And true to his word, the very next day, by FedEx, compliments to that organization, a heavy package arrived of documents from Gastrusek. But the first thing we noticed when it arrived was that the label on it did not say Washington, D.C., where he had been when we talked to him on the phone.
He was with the NIH at the time.
Camp Detrick in Maryland, and that was, of course, the research base for a lot of biological warfare, later changed into a so-called cancer research station by Richard Nixon. So we had the package of Gastrusek material, and it has proved infinitely helpful to us in our research. So we went started from there, and we noticed in the Gastrusek's papers, when he was down in New Guinea, he made reference to Bjorn Sigurdsson. Well, there was something for us to pick up. We looked up Bjorn Sigurdsson. When I say we looked up, it means we searched all the sources we could possibly search with the great help of the librarians at the Laurentian Hospital in Sudbury. They were very, very gracious, and they used to find us material that was very obscure and get it to us very shortly. And they got us a lot of information on Sigurdsson, and that was another step in our path to discovery about the origin of AIDS. Sigurdsson was a doctor in Iceland, and he was a very good doctor. He was very well qualified. But in 1942, he turned up in New York, going to the Rockefeller Medical Facility there, Rockefeller Medical University, I think it was, and he was studying the viral diseases of plants and animals. And we wondered, well, why does he want to know about plants and animals if he's a doctor of human medicine? And then we realized that one of the agents he was looking at was a retrovirus called, it was a retrovirus, and what it did was it took RNA, which is the ribonucleic acid, and which normally comes from DNA and does various things in the human body, creates various enzymes and tissues and so on. And the particular retroviruses that Sigurdsson was studying were retroviruses that in plants and in animals, especially in sheep, and this retrovirus in sheep would go back into the DNA of the sheep, and so that every time the cell of the sheep reproduce themselves, they also reproduce the disease agent.
And of course, I think it's important that they produced a disease called scrappy. And of course, it had, in the sheep, it caused the same sort of disease you saw among the four tribe in New Guinea. In other words, a progressive brain disease, which eventually killed the sheep. It was a Vizna virus, and we'll be back, because this, of course, is an important part of understanding AIDS. So pick up the story there, Don.
Yes, well, as you mentioned, the disease in sheep was called scrapie. And up to that point in history, there was no recorded evidence that any retrovirus had ever entered into a human being. They probably had entered into human beings hundreds of thousands of years before, but had the people, the carriers had died off from the disease, and it didn't establish a foothold in humanity, but it established a foothold in sheep and certain other animals, but especially sheep. Well, here's Dr. Sigurdsson, with this specialized knowledge of this animal disease, scrapie, and it was called scrapie because the animals would get so itchy, they would rub up against trees or posts and rub the fur off their pelts to make them far less valuable as an economic resource. And he knew that this terrible disease agent, if it ever got into humans, would be a very important human disease because it would reproduce itself when the cells reproduce themselves, and there would be very little possible cure for it that it knew of then, certainly. And that, it turns out, is exactly what the so-called AIDS virus is. There's a particle of a disease agent, and it's not actually the virus itself. It has never really been identified in human beings, but the particles in AIDS victims are practically identical to the scrapie retroviruses in sheep. And Segerson turned up in New York working for all people, of all people, for the Rockefellers. And the Rockefellers at that time were very, very interested in devoting an awful lot of money to ways and means of limiting the growth of the world's population. And he spent 2 years in New York, and then he went back to Iceland with several hundred thousand dollars of Rockefeller's money, where he established an experimental institution for the study of pathological diseases. Well, not only were they to be pathological diseases, but there were to be experimental stations. In other words, if there was a disease that was known that wasn't affecting mankind, they would experiment to find out if they could affect mankind. And he wrote several papers about scrapie in human beings, along with other researchers. And he took all this Rockefeller money back to Iceland with him. Now, this is all on the record. This is available in history books, and this is available to anybody who wants to look it up. And he established this institution in Iceland, and it was Rockefeller money that did it. And Iceland at that time was under the occupation of the American Army. A lot of people don't know this, but the American Army invaded Iceland when the Second World War, when America entered the Second World War, because they thought, well, we better get in there before the Germans get in there. And the British came along and took over from the British.
Don, hold the thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Don is telling us about a doctor who came from Iceland to New York and worked for the Rockefellers for some time. He was interested in a disease called scrapie, a disease of Icelandic sheep, that produced a progressive neurological disease very, very similar to koru, which, of course, appeared in New Guinea, and, of course, both diseases actually caused progressive destruction of the brain. So then, of course, this doctor actually returns to Iceland with a great deal of Rockefeller money and begins studying this sheep disease. It's called a Vizanavirus. It's a retrovirus. It's an RNA virus rather than a DNA virus, and it destroys the minds and the brains of sheep. And it is almost identical, of course, to what they were seeing over there in New Guinea among the natives over there. So pick the story up.
Yes, well, Dr. Segerson was back there in Iceland experimenting with scrapie, and he was looking at this retrovirus, which acted by putting down the immune system of its victims. That was one of the qualities it had, but it had a number of other qualities as well. And Dr. Segerson was just back in his nice new many-hundred-thousand-dollar institution, courtesy of the Rockefellers, when, of all things, up in northern Iceland, away from all kinds of built-up population areas such as Reykjavik, away up there in the north in Akureyri, Iceland, a disease broke out among the students in the local school. And over 1,000 students became sick with a mysterious disease that seemed to be something like polio, actually, but it wasn't. And one of its main characteristics was it was extremely fatiguing. And also, there was something very strange about it. 5 of the student victims, even though they're only in their teens, 15, 16 years old, in 5 of them, the disease turned into Parkinson's disease, and the students died. And Parkinson's disease, of course, is very, very closely related in its characteristics to what's known as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is what the New Guinea natives called Kuru. So we have a thread from Kuru to Creutzfeldt-Jakob to Parkinson's to a disease in northern Iceland. And lo and behold, who was on site to study this disease? Why, Dr. Bjorn Sigurdsson. And after a couple of years of his studying this disease, which very conveniently broke out and allowed him to study it, there was a delegation of almost 50 people arrived in Iceland, and they did all kinds of studies on the students who had, many of them actually never recovered from the disease, but some of them had relatively recovered. And the delegation of 50 people was sent to Iceland by, guess who, the Rockefeller Foundation. And they were studying this disease. Now, you may wonder, well, what's this got to do with AIDS? Well, the thing is that AIDS, acquired immune deficiency, is an immune deficiency disease, and the chronic fatigue that these people suffered from is also an immune deficiency disease. So here the Americans had, through the Rockefellers and their research and their studies, had at least some kind of scientific foothold on a disease which could either kill, which was AIDS, or disable, which was chronic fatigue. Now, why would they be interested in having 2 diseases from one disease agent? Well, the thing was, the Rockefellers wanted to limit the growth of the world's population. This is available in all kinds of textbooks, history and political textbooks, that are available to anybody who wants to start looking it up. And the thing is, they could kill off, tragically, they could kill off 8,000 black people a day, as is happening this very day with AIDS, and nobody really get very excited about it. This is a terrible indictment of human beings, but it is a reality, it is a fact.
Well, I think
and the American people have seen it most recently when Pastor Jeremy Wright said that the Americans developed AIDS and aimed it at the black people of America. Well, he was almost right.
Well,
it wasn't the black people of America that Sigurdsson had in mind and the Rockefellers had in mind. It was the black people of Africa. And they wanted to decimate the African population so that the vast resources of that great continent would be available to the American industrial machine.
Hold that thought, Don. Hey. Hold that. We're going to bring our stations on board here. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Don Scott, and we're talking about the origin of AIDS. We're talking about Don's book, which we incidentally do carry. It's called AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief. AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief. And we're talking about how this disease has been targeted at the blacks. Now, when Reverend Wright, who is Barack Obama's minister, talked about, you know, this idea that they had actually created AIDS to kill off the blacks, Everybody scoffed at that, and yet if you look at the statistics, and I have them from the Centers for Disease Control, we'd be glad to send any of our listeners who have any question. I have the latest report from the CDC on the incidence of AIDS in America, and that's as of 2006. And basically they point out that in the United States, living with AIDS at the present time, about 150,000 whites, but 190,000 blacks, 80,000 Hispanics. So why is the disease so much more prevalent in blacks and Hispanics? Why? Because this is a genetic-specific disease. It's much more prevalent in blacks than in whites. Blacks make up 10% of our, 12% of our population. Whites probably make up 60 or 70% of the population. And yet, of course, here you find 190,000 blacks and 150,000 whites in the United States carry the disease. You go to Africa, you can go into Botswana, where, of course, the United States Commerce Department is tracking the disease. And what do we find? Well, we find there, of the pregnant women in Botswana, 46% are HIV infected, and they're all going to die. How could you have that happen? I mean, what are we going to do to stop it? Absolutely nothing. People in Botswana, public health authorities, want to do what's logical, try to identify people with the disease and stop its spread, and of course they were not allowed to do that. The World Health Organization is managing the AIDS epidemic. They're doing such a good job. Why would you change things? So pick up the story there, Don.
Yes. Well, the white experimenters could kill off, as I say, 8,000 black people a day and not really raise that much of a fuss. Now just imagine, 8,000 people died today of AIDS, and you probably, and the average person probably never even gave it a thought, because these are 8,000 basically black people living in a distant continent. Now, the thing is, you couldn't kill off 8,000 people in the United States, Canada, Great Britain, West Germany, France, and so on.
Hold that thought, Don. We're going to bring the other stations on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Don is pointing out the fact that this AIDS epidemic is specifically, majority of it is in blacks. It's not here in the United States. It's not broken out in the major white population. It's broken out in the black population. And as I pointed out, the latest statistics show in the United States, 150,000 whites living with the disease, 190,000 blacks living with the disease, 80,000 Hispanics. Well, the whites make up 60, 65, 70% of the population. The blacks, 13%. Why are there so many more blacks that are HIV infected than whites? And very simply, why? Because this disease is genetic specific. It's race specific. We have the studies on that, and I'm sure Don does as well. They knew exactly what they were doing. They now have the ability to create diseases that are certainly are for specific racial groups. And AIDS is a group designed to kill out blacks. That's why, as Don points out, 8,000 blacks died today. 8,000 blacks died today of AIDS. And who in America is really concerned about it? Is anybody? I haven't heard anybody talking about it recently. Pick up the story there, Don.
Yes, now the tragedy is that people get so excited about Pastor Wright suggesting that AIDS was developed in order to limit the black population. They should actually be getting excited about 8,000 people a day dying of AIDS. However, we're talking about Sigurdsson and the outbreak of Akureyri or disease in Ireland, in Iceland. Why would that come about? Well, the thing is that if you put down a person's immune system, you make them vulnerable to certain diseases. And if the immune system alone is just put down, but there's no deadly cofactor involved, the people will simply become very, very ill with what we call chronic fatigue. Now, that was the door by which my son and I entered this whole area of study. Way back in 1996, we knew nothing about AIDS. We knew nothing about chronic fatigue syndrome. But the lady with chronic fatigue had asked for our help. We began to study chronic fatigue, and lo and behold, within a very short period of time, studying scientific objective papers, we realized that chronic fatigue was a non-lethal version of AIDS. Now, a lot of people would get turned off by this suggestion because there is, in American AIDS victims, often a sexual connotation that puts people off, or did put them off. And the people with chronic fatigue, there's no sexual connotation involved with the disease, but the disease is very, very effective, especially in hitting women. Women get chronic fatigue about 5 or 6 times more frequently than men do, and we found out the reason for that. And we realized that this fitted into the pattern of population control, because the ladies who were ill with chronic fatigue, their whole life, sex life especially, was one of the things that was tragically affected. Their ability to raise children was drastically affected. So what the U.S. had was a disease agent which could kill selected people and target the blacks, and we found out how they did that. And as an alternative to that, among the white population, they had a disease which could affect women and target women, and we found out how they could target women with this disease agent. And here was Dr. Stevenson out there in Iceland with the first heavily recorded record of chronic fatigue epidemic in Iceland, and here are 50 people plus from the Rockefeller Foundation there studying the disease and all the rest of it. Now, there's another side to this story. AIDS is often called a disease of cofactors. That is to say, there's one thing plus another. And it's the plus the other that makes it unique. Something was happening in the United States around this time that introduced a very, very important cofactor. And that cofactor was a disease agent called the mycoplasma. It had been discovered way back in the late 1800s by two French scientists, Drs. Nocard and Roux, working for the Pasteur Institute. But because this mycoplasma is so small, and because it lacks a cell wall, it is very, very, very hard to detect. But it is there nonetheless. Now, in the late 1940s and early 1950s, now this is the other side of the AIDS cofactor story, there was a disease breaking out every spring among naval recruits. It was a disease that caused what they called walking pneumonia. The young recruits in the different Navy bases almost every spring, 10, 12, 20% would come down with walking pneumonia, a mild case of pneumonia which didn't do them any serious physical harm but did interrupt their training procedures and limit the all the plans that were made to staff ships and all the rest of it with the graduating students. So a doctor by the name of Dr. Robert Huebner was hired by the Navy, and he was asked to study this springtime outbreak, and he began analyzing different samples from the Navy recruits who were ill, and he called the disease Pearl pneumonia, and he discovered Very dramatically, he discovered a strange organism in these students, which he called a pleural pneumonia organism. And it wasn't for a couple of years that other scientists said to him, "Hey, Dr. Huebner, that isn't a pleural pneumonia organism. That is a mycoplasma that's causing that disease." And this mycoplasma caused this lung disease among the recruits every spring, because the recruits were all living so closely together that if you were exposed to one person carrying a mycoplasmal infection, you were not exposed to him for an hour or two, and then you were on your way, and he was on his way. You were exposed to him when you were eating lunch. You were exposed to him when you were in class. You were exposed to him when you went to bed in the next bunk. So this mycoplasma was able to spread around among recruits because of the concentration of people living so close together for a period of several months. And then Dr. Huebner discovered something else. He discovered that not only did these recruits have the very obvious pneumonia, they also had adenoids that degenerated what he called spontaneously. In other words, the adenoids, which are kind of like guards at the gate to the lungs, when a person breathed in, if the breath that they breathed in had a mycoplasma in it, it would have to pass the adenoids. And enough of it, if it passed the adenoids, would affect the adenoids. And what did the adenoids do? They spontaneously degenerated certain cells in the adenoids, and these were lymph cells or immune disease control cells. So, hey, here is a disease agent which will affect the immune system and put the immune defenses down and open the door for retroviruses which had never affected humankind before. And Dr. Huebner, he became very, very important in the American medical establishment, especially with the military, and with a guy called Dr. Robert Gallo a few years later. And Huebner identified the fact, as I say, that the disease agent was a mycoplasma. Now, a lot of people have never heard of the mycoplasma. And if you turn to the Johns Hopkins medical book, 1,800 pages of information about medical problems for the human, for the American family, from Johns Hopkins University, which touts itself as being the most important medical institution in America for the average American family, and one which they say gets the largest grants from the National Institutes for Health and the Centers for Disease Control. They tout this themselves. If you turn to that book of theirs, nowhere in those 1,800 pages will you find the word mycoplasma. And nowhere in most textbooks will you find the words mycoplasma, because there was a distinct, careful effort made to take this discovery by Huebner and not only keep it secret, but to build on it. So what did they do? The American government, at American taxpayers' expense, established a mycoplasma research laboratory at Stanford University in California, and they collected all kinds of samples of mycoplasma infectious agents, and they made these available to other researchers who were researching certain things on behalf of the U.S. government. So now you had two things. You had the retrovirus, where the RNA of the human being, if it could be made to get into the human being, would backfire into the DNA and cause the disease to self-perpetuate. And you had an agent which would put the immune system down, the mycoplasma. And then it was realized that, hey, if these two things are together, the immune system is put down, the retrovirus has its way, a deadly disease results. Now, if you just put the immune system down, then you have not a deadly disease, but you have a disabling disease, especially disabling for women. And as I say, one of the early achievements of our foundation, the Common Cause Medical Research Foundation, was to explain why the mycoplasma especially affects women and causes a chronic fatigue, which in turn puts women essentially out of normal life. They're still alive. They still want to do things. They still want to share life with their families. But some of them are so totally fatigued, a great number of them take their own lives. So you had two diseases now. We then came upon a document where Dr. Donald MacArthur, and you've spoken of this on your program many times, Dr. Stan, you know the document well. On June the 9th, 1969, Dr. MacArthur briefed a number of congressmen. Now, these are congressmen. These are men who are elected to Congress to represent the people of the United States of America. And Dr. MacArthur met with them on June the 9th, 1969, and he told them that the microbiologists were working on a new disease which would be refractory to the human immune system. He also told them that they would have two elements. There would be a fatal disease, and there would be a disabling disease. There you have it, AIDS and chronic fatigue, and both of the diseases emerged in 1981, but there's more to that story than meets the eye, and we'll get to it shortly. But as a background, we have Dr. Gajdusek discovering Kourou, which is Kristvald Jakob, and we have Sigurdsson down there in Iceland, and we have Huebner in the United States, and they have between them discovered the retrovirus and the mycoplasma, and now is the time to put it to work. And Dr. Smadel of the Walter Reed Hospital recruited another Rockefeller employee named Hillary Koprowski. And you can see evidence of this in our book. We actually record the day in January of a number of years ago, I forget the exact date, when Koprowski was introduced by Smadel to certain other people who were involved in biological research, and they were interested in developing what they said was a vaccine that would fight against polio. Well, this is what is called a very sexy project among medical practitioners and researchers, because the families of America can identify with anything that will fight polio. So when the U.S. government appropriated all kinds of money to establish the Wistar Institute and put Koprowski in charge of it to research how to stop polio, there was no problems at all. But then, what did Koprowski do? Well, he aligned himself up with the Belgians in the Congo, and he went over to the Congo to a place that the Belgian government established for him called Camp Lindy, and in Camp Lindy, several hundred chimpanzees had been captured by the Belgians and put into this camp for Koprowski's use. And Koprowski was supposed to be developing a vaccine against polio. Well, actually, he was trying to develop a vaccine against polio. But he was also trying to do something else. He was trying to find how the mycoplasma could affect the chimpanzees, because the chimpanzee has the closest identification with the human genome, and if something works on the chimpanzee, the chances are it'll work on the human being. And so Koprowski was down there in Camp Lindy in Belgium, Congo, experimenting to find a cure or a vaccine against polio, and he was doing honest work in that area. But this is what's called a cover. Underneath the cover of researching polio, the evidence is very, very strong, and you only have to read a very important book called The River by Ed Hooper to know that underneath the polio research, there was a great effort to do something else. Now, Ed Hooper's a very decent person and a very careful researcher, and he thinks that by mistake, the mycoplasmal retroviral disease known as AIDS got into human beings, because he thinks maybe some of these chimpanzees that were being worked on by Koprowski had given the disease to man, And I think that, despite his tremendous research, this is the area that Ed Hooper is wrong. The disease didn't come from the chimps to the men to humanity. The disease went from humanity to the chimps.
Uh-oh.
And there was never a case of a chimp in wild circumstances having the disease agent. But a number of chimps who were exposed to Kapowski's research did
hold,
turn
hold
out
that
to
thumb,
have
hold that thumb right there. Out. Okay, go right ahead, Don. Don, go right ahead.
Well, Dr. Kapowski was doing that work down in Belgium.
Belgium Congo, right.
The Americans, researchers, wanted to do some work in the United States itself, and so they recruited Dr. Alton Ochsner. Now, Dr. Ochsner was with Tulane University in New Orleans, and he needed some monkeys, such as the ones that were held by Kapowski in Camp Lindy in Belgium, but they couldn't raise that many chimpanzees in America. But they did establish, just outside of New Orleans in Covington, Louisiana, the Delta Primate Farm. And in the Delta Primate Farm, they raised rhesus monkeys. Then they took the rhesus monkeys and killed them and mashed up their kidneys, because they found that the mashed up kidneys were the best possible place to raise the mycoplasma disease organism that they were interested in. So this is about the time politically it became very potentially likely that work would be done on such a population control work, because simultaneously with this research going on and these discoveries going on and so on, there was a political change. The Americans went from a Democrat Truman to a Republican Eisenhower. Now, Eisenhower was a great man, just like MacArthur. But Eisenhower was a military man, and he was a kind of person, it seems, who liked to delegate tasks and then leave people alone to do the tasks they were delegated. And he wanted Nelson Rockefeller in his cabinet. So he said, asked Rockefeller, or would you like to be in the cabinet? Nelson Rockefeller, or the great Rockefeller family and the great population control establishment, said, oh, yes, very much so. I would like to be assistant secretary to the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. Well, what did Nelson Rockefeller know about health, which was his particular interest? The thing is, he didn't know that much. But what he wanted to do was to take the work of the military and meld that research work in with the work of the National Institutes of Health and with the work of the Centers for Disease Control, and make the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health.
Hold that thought, Don. Hold that thought, Don. We're getting the stations coming up. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is the time that we're drawing to the end of this hour. If you'd like to hear the entire tape, why, they are available, and Don and I talk when the ads are running. But let me point out simply that Don is talking about the fact that Nelson Rockefeller became the Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services in the Eisenhower administration, because the Rockefeller family is dedicated to population control. And this is really what AIDS is all about. It is an example of population control. People find it difficult to believe that could be true, but actually, of course, we have the writings of Bertrand Russell in his book, The Impact of Science on Society, where Bertrand Russell talks about the fact you can't kill enough people through abortion, you can't even kill enough people through war. But the best way to control the population would be a black plague to sweep the world once in every generation. If you'd like to see those pages, they are contained in our syllabus on the Hidden Agenda, along with my DVD on the Hidden Agenda, going into the background of water fluoridation. But we actually have permission from the publisher of Bertrand Russell's book, The Impact of Science on Society, to reproduce those pages, and they are available to you. In the syllabus, the hidden agenda. You need to read it. You need to hold those pages in your hand and understand there really are people who actually promote the idea of a black death sweeping throughout the world once in every generation. Well, this is the time I want to tell you about Don's book, which we do carry. It's called AIDS, the Crime Beyond Belief. AIDS, the Crime Beyond Belief is must reading for anybody who really wants to understand what is going on. We also carry Len Horowitz's excellent book entitled, Len Horowitz's excellent book on the AIDS epidemic, and he goes into certainly the background of the creation of this terrible, terrible disease. You really need to get my material on population control. And, of course, that's my talk on None Dare Call It Genocide. That's None Dare Call It Genocide. And then my talk on planned population reduction, and then my talk on just plain old population control. And then, of course, you need to get my monograph. It's very inexpensive. It's available up on the Internet. But, of course, you can get the directly from us if you want to. It's called Global Population Control Agenda. Population Control Agenda. And then, of course, the book we were thinking of by Dr. Horowitz is Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola. That's Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola. I believe an important book as well, but if you're going to get one book right now, I would think AIDS, the Crime Against Belief. You need to get the information. You need to understand that there really are people who have no respect for human life. And then again, this takes you to my DVDs. None Dare Call It Genocide, Planned Population Reduction, and Population Control. We also have a great four-tape set on population control going into the outlawing of DDT, which has probably killed close to 100 million people since we outlawed DDT back in 1973. That is the four-tape set on population control. So the material is available. If you want more information, my telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. How do you put these things into any sort of rational framework? Because how could anybody be that evil? And that's the term that Don Scott uses in his book, The Evil That We Face. Well, you need to actually hear my talk on The Forbidden Secret. That's The Forbidden Secret, and there's a syllabus that comes with that. My talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that is very important, because we take the writings of what the people on the other side say, and you'll actually see examples of the material they're circulating among the people on the other side. And then lastly, of course, my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness. You can get the book, you can get the DVD. You need to have the information. You need to help us get it out. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV. More. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and for the next hour, again, there'll be the views of Don Scott, and we're going to be talking about the book that he and his son wrote entitled AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief. Now, as you read the book, of course, Don talks about the establishment, the Rockefeller-controlled establishment, and, of course, how it interlocks with people of great wealth throughout the world who are dedicated to population control. He also talks about the Central Intelligence Agency, which is simply an armed extension of the establishment. And, of course, we know, of course, that the CIA was working on these population control programs and was certainly working behind the scenes, along with the military, to come up with new diseases, new and terrible diseases that would be killing millions, countless millions of people. And, of course, if you, Don had referred to Dr. David MacArthur's testimony in June of 1969 before the House Military Appropriations Committee, where he talked about how they would have the ability in the future to create new diseases. One would be a chronic disease that would kill people. It would be no immune response to it. A new means of mass killing was the term he used. A new means of mass killing. Some people say we shouldn't do it because it could be a new means of mass killing, but we want to do it. And then the chronic disease, it would be so disabling. And Don has pointed out that the acute disease was AIDS, and the chronic disease is chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, the disease which probably has about 3 million people in it in the United States today, totally disabling for those tragic people who have it. So with that as the background, you pick the story up, Don.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. In the United States, Alton Ochsner of Tulane University had the Delta Primate Farm outside of Covington, outside of New Orleans, established and began raising rhesus monkeys, taking their kidneys and growing on the kidney mash the mycoplasma. Rockefeller was appointed Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services and Education and Welfare at that time, and he melded the NIH and made it into a criminal organization at its very highest level, tied in with the criminal elements of the United States Army, and they're very significant in their number. And they started working together, and we have a number of research papers financed by the military in cooperation with NIH, experimenting and dealing with elements of scrapie and the mycoplasma. And in New Orleans, especially, the CIA established a program which had a cryptonym, a name which would mean something to them, but wouldn't mean anything to the average person. And the cryptonym started with MK. Well, we found out in many, many pieces of literature what the MK stands for. It stands for monkey kidneys. They were going to do experiments with monkey kidneys, and they had one program called MK Ultra, which was the umbrella research in the organization under Rockefeller. And under the MK Ultra, there was a sub-program called MK Delta, and the Delta was for the Mississippi Delta, and Alton Ochsner and his monkeys, well told in the histories given by Ed Haslam in his book Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Viruses. And there was MK Ultra, MK Delta. And these two programs were to develop the they were to take these discoveries by Gajdusek, Huebner, and Kopowski, and the rest of them, and make them into working diseases. And so there were the two areas. There was the chimp kidney area in Belgium, Congo, under Koprowski, there was a rhesus monkey area in Covington, near Louisiana, under Alden Ochsner, but they were both working with the mycoplasma, and they were both working with vaccines. Now, Koprowski began using his vaccines in among the natives of Africa, and every black American they get their hands on, he stuck a needle into them. Now, the thing is that they actually were using a vaccine against polio, but in that vaccine, for certain areas, they had it laced with the other vaccines that they were working with, which were related to the mycoplasma. And Alden Ochsner was very well known and very much respected in a Portuguese colony, formerly Portuguese colony of Brazil, and he largely used his research discoveries with the MK Delta product in Brazil and other Portuguese colonies. Now, this explains to anybody who is puzzled over it why there are actually two strains of AIDS in the world. There's one strain of AIDS which is based upon chimpanzees' kidneys, and another strain of AIDS which is based upon rhesus monkey kidneys. So you had AIDS 1 and AIDS 2. And this is because it was the whole effort was being directed by laboratory scientists who understood what they were doing. And the work was proceeding there, and was under the guidance of the CIA, and when Rockefeller finished with his work in health and educational welfare, he asked Eisenhower for a new job. And Eisenhower said, "What job would you like?" And he said he'd like to work with Alan Dulles in the CIA. So Dulles and Dulles worked with Rockefeller to establish these political programs, MK Ultra and MK Delta, and they then began experimenting with putting these.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Don Scott. We're talking about his disease, AIDS, the crime beyond belief. And, of course, Don has pointed out there were two centers where they were actually working and growing these viruses. One was in Africa, the Belgian Congo, under Koprowski. The other was, of course, outside of New Orleans under Ochsner, Dr. Ochsner. And so this is why, of course, we seem to have two major types of HIV. One, of course, is the HIV-2. That would be the one in Africa. HIV-1 would be, of course, the one that was grown in the United States under the auspices of the Ochsner Clinic, or at least Dr. Ochsner. And there is a book that gets into this somewhat, and it's a book called Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. And, of course, Ferry was the same Ferry that was involved with, of course, the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, but that's an entirely different story. Don, you picked the story up. You've made the point that now there were two types, two centers where they were developing these diseases, combination of the Vizsla Zika virus, which became HIV, lentivirus, and, of course, then the mycoplasma, which was really the pathological part of this. But, of course, we never talk about that. I mean, everything is done to discourage the public from understanding that this is not one disease, but it's two diseases working together to destroy lives all throughout the world, but predominantly in Africa, where it's predominantly killing blacks. Pick up the story, please.
All right, Dr. Stan, and in respect to your remark that the murder of Mr. Kennedy and the development of AIDS are two different stories, we discovered, tragically, they're not. The same people who were behind the murder of President John F. Kennedy were the people who were behind the development of the AIDS cofactors. And that is seen in Ed Haslam's book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. Says, as you say, Ferry, David Ferry, was a friend, supposedly, of Lee Harvey Oswald, who was fingered as the patsy to take the blame for the murder of the president. And Ferry, at the same time, was a friend of Mary Sherman, a researcher with Dr. Alton Ochsner, Tulane University. And in his part-time, Ferry was raising mice which he was infecting with monkey viruses, and the whole thing all ties together. But anyway, focusing on the AIDS part of it, the mycoplasma puts down the immune system, opens the body to diseases that previously didn't affect the human being that much, and they especially wanted to target black people. Why target black people? Well, at the very introduction, I mentioned the fact that Africa is a nation or a continent of great, great, great resources and huge population. If you reduce the population, you have more access to the resources, and that's what the United States wanted. And in part of the research that they did, they were working with the mycoplasma, and they were trying to find out how it affected black people. Now, this is not hocus-pocus, or this is not theory or imagination or something. You can go to the laboratory or to the libraries of any good hospital or any good university, and you can look up an article written in 1953, that critical period when the Dr. Huebner was at work and Dr. Sigerson was at work and Dr. Kowalski was at work. You can find in that, under 1953, an article by Dr. Maurice Shepherd, and the title of the article is The Recovery of Pearl Pneumonia-like Organisms. Well, that's the mycoplasma that we talked about. The mycoplasma. Now listen to this. The recovery of pearl pneumonia-like organisms from Negro men. Now what does the research tell us? Well, the research tells us that Dr. Shepherd took 100 healthy Negro men who were college students. He picked college students because they were less subject to various diseases that otherwise might get transferred among people with less education and less focus for their life. And he compared their blood with the blood from 100 healthy white men. And what did he discover? He discovered that black people naturally, normally, and quite healthily, automatically carry, 30% of them, automatically carry the mycoplasma. If you test their blood, they've got the mycoplasma in it, but it does them no harm. Only 2% of white men carry the mycoplasma. So you have 30 black men carrying the mycoplasma naturally and doing them no harm, and you have 30 or 2 white men. Now, if this disease agent is a cofactor with a disease agent based on the retroviruses of sheep and Dr. Sigerson's work, then the black man already, 30 out of 100, already have one of the cofactors, whereas only 2 out of 100 white men have it. And he put this into a report which was made available then to the researchers working on population control disease agents. And it brings out the fact that there is a scientific basis why black men or black people are 15 times more liable to have AIDS than white people are exposed to the same disease agents because the black person genetically already carries the mycoplasma in 30 out of 100 cases. This was a very important factor for them to base their continuing research on, but now the problem arose. How do we get this combination of one cofactor into the black people of Africa? And this is where you have to study the history of the times, and you have to study the fact that, first of all, when President Kennedy came into power, they immediately put all of these research efforts on hold, and there's no evidence that they told Kennedy any of it was going on. Kennedy was very much against the idea of population control. He thought that if people were given a high enough standard of living and a regular job and a healthy family, that you wouldn't have to try to control the size of the family. The families would do that themselves. So for 3 years there was a hiatus, and then Mr. Kennedy was killed, and he was killed by that, purportedly by Lee Harvey Oswald and his friend David Ferry, a friend of Mary Sherman, employee of Alton Ochsner. And presidency was taken over by Lyndon B. Johnson. Now, what was Lyndon B. Johnson's stand on this? He was all for population control. And he appointed a new population control committee chaired by or co-chaired by a member of the Rockefeller family and by Mr. William Cohan. And these men then were responsible for bringing together all the information they had, some of it in secret and some of it publicly, about methods of population control. And in his book, his biography of the times, Lyndon B. Johnson, in his book, The Vantage Point, says that when he came into power, i.e. he succeeded Mr. Kennedy, only $6 million a year was being spent on population control. And he says, under my administration, we increased that amount to over $140 million a year. Now you can imagine going from $6 million to $140 million. What were they paying for? And our book traces this because they established several programs. First program they called the viral oncology, under the theory that cancer was transmitted by a virus. And then they dropped the viral oncology and they developed what they called a special virus leukemia lymphoma program. And then they changed that to a special virus cancer program because, again, we're back to the polio thinking. You needed something that was sexy for people in order for the public to support the program. So after the program got reestablished with Lyndon Johnson, if you read the story, you will have to admit when you see the evidence that Lyndon Johnson was a very, very dishonest person. And when he was succeeded by Mr. Nixon, Mr. Nixon took the role of National Security Advisor and gave it to Rockefeller protege Henry Kissinger, and they were off and running again with this whole program of AIDS cofactors, but they had to get it into black people in Africa, and they had to get it into white people in North America and in Europe and in Australia. How do you do that? Well, the easy way to get the AIDS cofactors into people is to give them a vaccination. And you can't say to them, come and get a vaccination that will kill you in 5 years' time. You've got to have something more attractive than that. So they went to Africa and they said, we'll give you all a free vaccination which will help you, will prevent you getting smallpox. And even though a lot of black people didn't want the vaccination, they were made to take it at the point of the gun of Belgian soldiers, Portuguese soldiers, British soldiers in South Africa, and French soldiers. So the idea was to vaccinate the black population of Africa against smallpox, laced, the evidence is very strong, that it was laced with the cofactors, mycoplasma, and retrovirus. And within 5 years of that program being completed, many, many of the people who had taken the vaccine, some 60%, were presenting with the symptoms of AIDS.
Hold that thought right there, Don. We'll be back in just a moment here, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Don, go right ahead. You were just saying, of course, with the smallpox vaccination, within 5 years, a significant part of the people who had taken that vaccination now had come down with AIDS. Go ahead.
Yes, and the areas that took the vaccinations in greater numbers are the areas today where AIDS is in its greatest numbers, especially in South Africa. Now, you couldn't say to the white population of North America and Britain and so on, come and get a vaccination against smallpox, because there literally was no smallpox in those countries. But they did have a way of getting the vaccine into a certain part of the population that some of these homophobic people in the military and so on had targeted. And that was the people who were homosexuals. Working with Dr. Koprowski in Camp Lindy in Belgium was a doctor called Fritz Reinhardt. And Fritz was working on a vaccine against hepatitis.
That's hepatitis B.
Time in the,
that was hepatitis B. That was the hepatitis B vaccine, wasn't it?
Yes, one of the three varieties anyway. And Dr. Reinhardt developed a vaccine against hepatitis. And the United States government demonstrated a very, very generous streak. Not only were they going to give a free smallpox vaccination to all the people in Africa, and it was paid for mostly by the United States government, and it was done by 17 teams from Atlanta, Georgia, who went over there to vaccinate the blacks. In the United States, they targeted the gay population, the gay men, and they put ads in the gay papers and said, if you are afraid that you will contact or someone with hepatitis and you might get the disease, you can get a free vaccine courtesy of the United States government. And so all kinds of gay men lined up and took a free vaccination against hepatitis. And lo and behold, like their African counterparts who'd taken a smallpox vaccine, these gentlemen who took the vaccine against hepatitis began to present with AIDS. And so it was in 1981 that the first instances of AIDS in America were reported by Dr. Gottlieb in the medical press. And this fits in with the timetable that had been given to the congressman by Dr. MacArthur when he told them in 1969 that if they gave him the money in 70, within 5 to 10 years, i.e. 1980, they could have this new disease agent which would be refractory to the immune system, and lo and behold, that's what they had. So doctors, Koprowski and so on, had seen their efforts coming to fruit here, and these vaccine programs were putting them into the gay population of North America and into the black population of Africa, and you had the epidemic of AIDS in two different varieties, because there was the one variety developed by Dr. Alton Ochsner and given mainly in Portuguese colonies, and the other variety developed in Camp Lindy, which was given to the black population and to the population of American gay men. And the AIDS
hold that thought, we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Don was simply pointing out that they had developed a vaccine, a hepatitis B vaccine, and they put ads in the homosexual papers, and they recruited black men, homosexuals in the United States to take this hepatitis B vaccine. Of course, what it did, it contained the elements of the AIDS infection, the mycoplasma, the HIV, and of course, well, we know in San Francisco we have the papers we were able to get from the health department up there of the homosexual men who volunteered to take this hepatitis B vaccine experimental in the late 1970s, probably as 79, 1980. 75% of them have contracted AIDS. 75% of those people who took the hepatitis B vaccine. So you had, of course, the epidemic introduced in the United States in the homosexual population. You had it introduced in Africa by a different subtype of the same HIV-1 virus. Of course, you had the HIV-2 virus there as well. And we find, of course, we find different types of the virus all throughout the world, the type we have among the homosexuals, the white population in the United States, is an entirely different subtype than the subtypes they have in Africa. Nobody ever wants to ask why that happened. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, well, now, there was not just the two epidemics, the epidemic of chronic fatigue. Now, how did it come about? Well, it wasn't transmitted by vaccinations, but the American experimenters had to test ways and means of transmitting the mycoplasmal infectious agent to white people in North America. And basically, there were three ways of trying to do that. One was by using the mosquito vector, infect a bunch of mosquitoes with the disease agent, and then turn these loose among people. The other was put it into the air that people breathe, and the other was to put it into the food that they eat. And they tried all three of these methods. Most notably, they tried to they contaminated the milk in Lindenville, New York, and fed it to children, and many, many, many children came down with chronic fatigue in Lindenville area. And they put it into the air in a couple of, or in one of the rooms. It was very complicated, but nevertheless they did it, and you can study it in our book. They put it into the air in a high school in Tahoe, Truckee, where only a handful of eight teachers were exposed to it, and out of those eight, seven developed chronic fatigue syndrome. So it was obviously working, but it had problems because those people then could transmit it to other people. And they had the food, and they had the air, and now the mosquitoes. Well, they had a problem there. How do you get mosquitoes infected in order to test them? Well, they had a method. And this is where Canada participated, or was complicit in this terrible, terrible crime. They came up to the Canadian government, and they asked the Canadian government to breed 100 million mosquitoes a month. Now, this is a fact. And they, the Canadian government said they would do that. And at the Dominion Parasite Laboratory in Belleville, Ontario, Canada, they started breeding 100 million mosquitoes a month. And then they shipped those 100 mosquitoes a month to Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Now, we have all the records for this, Dr. Stan, and this is one of the great blessings of Canadian, gullibility in this whole thing. When they were doing this, it was all being done with the control of the military in Canada and so on, through the government and the Dominion Parasite Laboratory and Queen's University. But somebody in the cycle was sending copies of the correspondence to the National Research Council in Ottawa. And when the Watergate scandals hit the United States, everybody began investigating everybody else. The CIA discovered they better take all their records about MK Ultra, MK Delta, and scrap these, get rid of them totally, which they tried to do, and they were largely successful. But they forgot to tell the National Research Council in Ottawa, Canada, to get rid of their records. So those records are always are still there, and people who are authorized scientists can actually study them. And what happened was, they breed the mosquitoes in Belleville. They shipped them to Kingston. Queen's University doctors of science, Dr. Reed especially, contaminate those mosquitoes with, among other things, we speculate, because we have no evidence of what they did the contamination with, but obviously they used the mycoplasma. They contaminated the mosquitoes. They turned them over to the Canadian military, who shared them with the American military. And then these were tested. For example, the infected mosquitoes were let out one morning in Punta Gorda, Florida. And within a couple of weeks, the first great epidemic of chronic fatigue in Punta Gorda...
Hold that thought right there. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Don Scott. He was simply pointing out how they had infected the mosquitoes with mycoplasma, and then of course they took them and they brought them to the United States, and they released them in a place called Punta Gorda in Florida, where of course one of the great epidemics of chronic fatigue developed. So this was how they were going to begin circulating chronic fatigue to large parts of the population of America and certainly in Canada as well. Who would be evil enough to do this? Well, you only need to go back and read the writings of Zygmunt Brzezinski. Zygmunt Brzezinski in his book entitled Between Two Ages, and right now if you want to get a copy, you can get it up on the internet for about $100, $150. Book originally sold for $7. Between Two Ages, written in 1970, and there, of course, footnote, and I think it's on page 59, but don't hold me to it, it's very close to that. Why Zygmunt Brzezinski talks about how in the future we're going to be able to create storms and droughts. We hear about the tornadoes today there in the Midwest, and then we're going to be able to create new chronic diseases to disable the enemy. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are the enemy of the elite. Certainly Brzezinski, Henry Kissinger, work for the Rockefellers. They are part of the elite who rule our country, who rule the world. But they were quite willing to talk about creating these chronic diseases back in 1970, and of course, that's one reason why that book is so hard to get hold of. Between Two Ages by Zygmunt Brzezinski. We can always send you the pages if you want to see it. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, as Don Scott points out in his book, we're dealing with organized evil. Once you understand that, so much of what's going on makes sense. So, anyway, of course, Don has told us they've contaminated the mosquitoes. They turned them loose in the United States, and what happened, Don?
They turned them loose in a variety of ways, and the three major epidemics, Tahoe, Truckee, and Lindenville, New York, and Punta Gorda, Florida, were just the start. But one of the men doing the research into these diseases, so-called, on behalf of the Centers for Disease Control and so on, was Dr. Donald Henderson, who was later tapped to be in charge of the vaccination program against smallpox in Africa. And all the pieces fit together that they were able to develop and deploy the AIDS virus and, the so-called AIDS virus, which doesn't really exist. There are the two factors, the mycoplasma and the retrovirus. And the mycoplasma alone in women especially.
Hold that thought, Don. Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and right now, of course, before we go on, Don, I'd like you to get your website. Do you have a website available so people could know how to get in touch with you?
Unfortunately, the website is in my son's name. I only use the computer for the writing and storing data, and you would have to, how would you get that site? Perhaps we can provide it to you, Dr. Stan, and you can put it on your website.
All right, fine. We'll be glad to. And then, of course, if people wanted to get in touch with you, how would they get in touch with you?
The best way is to write to me. And because I'm 84 years old, and I'm retired except for my research into these diseases, and it's much, much easier for me to go for the mail and get letters and sit here in my study and open them and answer them. And if they write to me, Donald Scott, Box 133, Station B, as in Bob, Sudbury, Sudbury, Canada. Postal code is P as in Peter, 3, E as in Edward, 4, N as in Norman, 5. Donald Scott, Box 133, Station B, Sudbury, P3E, 4N5. If you write me a letter, I will reply. It'll take 2, 3, 4 weeks to get a reply, but I will reply. But I won't provide data that's available in articles and so on. I'll just tell you what the articles are, where they are, and then you can go and look them up yourself. Or, as a substitute, you can avail yourself of our book, which summarizes all of this, AIDS, the Crime Beyond Belief, and then we will answer specific questions that aren't covered.
All right, Brian. And Brian, the book is excellent. We do carry it, and if you want to get it, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. It's over 600 pages long. It's an amazing book, AIDS, the Crime Beyond Belief. So go ahead. Is that book of yours about the Skull Valley incident still available?
Yes, it is.
I think we carry that one as well.
I think you have to get I know that you can access it through Amazon or through the publisher itself, Trafford Publishing, and it's called The Extremely Unfortunate Skull Valley Incident. It deals mainly with the military background to all of this, as opposed to the disease effects seen in AIDS and chronic fatigue and in many other diseases, which I'd like to mention as well.
All right, we actually still carry that. We have that in stock, so that's extremely
important. Oh, good. Is available through yourself.
Right.
That's fine. Thank you.
All right, fine. Well, you go ahead and pick up the story there.
Now, also in our book, we have studied how these two terrible diseases, chronic fatigue and AIDS, impacted the general population who didn't get either disease, but who got other diseases related to the disease agents that were loosed among mankind. And we discovered that there is a huge link between the mycoplasma and cancer. And the epidemic of cancers that has been going on since the 1960s when David Ferry was doing his work with the monkey viruses and the mice in his New Orleans apartment, the increases of cancer since that time has been astronomical and is increasing all the time. And there is a very, very important mycoplasmal factor involved in cancers. Now, we include this in our book under collateral damage, and we look at the fact that Dr. Deborah Davis, who is a very important scientist in the whole realm of cancer in the United States, at the University of Pittsburgh, I believe it is. She has written a book about the secret war on cancer, which actually never existed, but it's a catchy title. But she makes the point in that book, in several different places in the book, that way more black people get cancer than white people do. Now, most people don't know that, but it is a fact. And if the statistics are analyzed, you see that the blacks are significantly higher in incidence than the whites. And again, that is because one of the cofactors involved in cancer, the mycoplasma, is already in 30 out of 100 black people. So it's a much easier step to go from that disease agent as a factor to present as cancer. And she analyzes the role of things that instigate the cancers, and she talks about various cancers, but this is a misleading because there aren't several cancers. There's one cancer, and that is the uncontrolled growth of human cells in the body. Now, that can take place in a variety of places in the body. It can take place in the brain, in the throat, in the esophagus, in the stomach, and so on. But there's only one thing going wrong, and that is the reproduction of cells without control. And the control ordinarily comes from a natural process in the body called apoptosis, where unnecessary cells literally commit suicide. However, it takes energy to commit suicide for these cells, and that energy comes from the mitochondria, which are the batteries of the human cells. And the mycoplasma destroys the mitochondria and its ability to generate energy, and hence limit apoptosis, and hence increase the amount of cancers. And this is going on at a huge rate. And people are marching along to the tune of Cancer Incorporated. They're doing such things as midnight walks, candle-lit walks, and all kinds of walk-a-thons and swim-a-thons and everything, raising money for research. But they're not doing the research where they know it is important to do it, and that is the role of the mycoplasma in cancer, just like the role of mycoplasma in chronic fatigue and in AIDS and in Parkinson's disease and in a whole range of other diseases. So this deadly agent, which was developed in laboratories throughout America and to an extent with Canadian laboratories, British laboratories, Australian laboratories, and Israeli laboratories. We have tracked expert research to all those countries, but it's under the direction of the military political power of the United States. And Pastor Wright was tragically quite correct when he said that AIDS was used to kill black Americans. Now, he was wrong in the sense that it wasn't just the black Americans, it was black people, period.
Well, that's, and certainly I believe he's, but I, of course, don't like Pastor Wright. I think he's a black racist, but just because he's a black racist doesn't mean what he said wasn't true. The thing is that everything that happened to ridicule him on that statement, that is a true statement. I believe there can be no question at all. This disease is designed to kill off blacks. It's predominantly killing blacks in the United States, predominantly killing blacks in Africa. So go ahead, pick up the story.
Yes, indeed. And our book not only covers the medical and scientific research that was being done and the testing that was being done in various areas and the various types of vector that were used, the mosquitoes bred in Canada and so on, and we're not proud of that at all. But the thing is, our book traces all of these factors and puts them together in one 660-page book that took us 12 years of work. And we're very pleased to make it available to people to at least think about. We say, don't agree with us and don't disagree. Read the evidence. Now, that'll put you to work, but it's a lot better to read the evidence and to know the real truth about the spread of AIDS and the spread of chronic fatigue and the spread of cancer and the spread of Parkinson's disease and these others that are related than it is to have those diseases. Much better to do the work ahead of time. And the relative ease with which these diseases can be responded to. You have to see the evidence to know what I'm saying here. And again, in our book, AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief, we therefore have a significant part on the politics of what the whole thing was based upon and who was at work sponsoring the programs, as well as the medical and scientific basis of the diseases themselves.
And I think what's so very interesting is that certainly Luc Montagnier, who was a man who originally discovered the HIV virus, but he also recognized the mycoplasma as a cofactor. He wanted to treat the AIDS patients with antibiotics. And everything has been done, of course, to discourage that, or Gallo attacked Montagnier for doing that, saying he's only going to confuse the issue. And yet, of course, they were getting much better results than we were. And instead, of course, we give them these terrible, terrible medicines, expensive medicines, and but really do not save the lives of the people because it doesn't cure the disease. Certainly, if you could knock up the mycoplasm, why, these people would not be dying. But you see, that isn't the agenda. The agenda is to kill as many people as you can. That's why you need to understand that there is a population control agenda. You need to get the... We have the testimony of Dr. David MacArthur before the House Appropriations Committee in 1969, available from Radio Liberty. We have the National Security Study Memorandum that came out of the government secret document 1974 over the name of Henry Kissinger, talking about the main thrust of American foreign policy, population control. Go right ahead, Don.
Yes, and the amazing thing is that so much of this material is available to the population at large and to the major media, but the major media who should be communicating this information to the population at large just don't do the job. And an example of this is you can get through Radio Liberty and your own program, I understand, a copy of the patent of the mycoplasma. This just shows the brass of these people. They not only develop, enhance the contagiousness of the mycoplasma and all the rest of it, but under Dr. Shai Ching Lo, the American Pathological or Pathology Institute, and the United States military, he's very, very high up in their ranks, they patented the mycoplasma, the pathogenic or disease-causing mycoplasma. And on page 22 of that document, a U.S. government patent by the top U.S. government doctor in the United States, it says that people who are infected with a mycoplasma infection will be people who have been diagnosed as having AIDS, chronic fatigue, sarcoidosis, lupus, Wegener's disease, cardiovascular diseases, and even Alzheimer's. Now, if you turn to any practicing doctor, and I said this on, I believe, the last program, go to your doctor, say to him, "Doctor, what causes Alzheimer's?" He will say, "Gosh, I don't know. I wish I knew, because if I knew, I could make a million." Well, he's nuts. He couldn't make a million because the mycoplasma is under the control of the U.S. government. They limit research on it and so on. But in one of their own patents, they state that people who have a mycoplasmal infection will include people diagnosed as having Alzheimer's, for example. And this is right out in plain sight, and yet none of the doctors have seen it. They only tell you what they've been taught in the medical schools. And in the U.S. military medical school, they have a whole section on the mycoplasma and its dangers. But in the average medical school, they don't have any mention at all of the mycoplasma. And in Johns Hopkins, that institution is really, I have to say, they're very corrupt in this whole area. They don't even put the word mycoplasma into their medical handbooks or so on. They keep it from the public. And if the mycoplasma were truly addressed, then all kinds of disease cases such as AIDS, chronic fatigue, cancers could be responded to much more in keeping with their scientific reality than is presently done. And the trouble is, this information, as they say, is there in plain sight for people to see if they get off their hind end and start looking at it, or if they listen to people who say it and then ask the people, "Well, where are your sources?" Then look at the articles that we've looked at and that we cite in our book. All kinds of articles, including the one by Dr. Shepherd, indicating that 30% of black people automatically have the mycoplasma, one of the cofactors for AIDS.
And I think it really, it's as you say, the crime beyond belief. It is so impossible to believe that most people would just shake their heads and say it could not be true. And I will have to admit that for a number of years, I really could not. I didn't want to accept the fact that this was population control, and our good friend Dr. Lorraine Day, who is involved in the battle to try to address the AIDS epidemic as a communicable disease, as I was back in the period between 1986 and about 1995. Dr. Lorraine Day kept telling me, though, this is population control, Stan, and you know, I wouldn't believe it. And finally, I'll have to admit, one day, of course, it became very, very obvious that they had no intention of trying to stop the spread of this terrible disease. Organized medicine, the government, the Centers for Disease Control had an agenda, and that was to kill as many people as they could. And when you, of course, came to that conclusion, and I came to that conclusion after going to the CDC in Atlanta and talking to some of the people there, and although Jim Curran was in charge, and I think he was a good man, the people who surrounded him were not. They were part of this population control agenda movement. And when you understand that, of course, so many other things make sense. Well, our guest this evening has been Don Scott. His book, AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief, well worthwhile reading. We've recommended it to you very strongly. We think it's so vitally important that you have an idea what this is all about. So you don't have to like Reverend Wright. I don't like Reverend Wright at all. I think he's a black racist, and that's unforgivable. But, of course, he wants to condemn all white men. And, of course, that's most white people would be as horrified as Don and I are about what's going on. Well, our guest this evening has been Don Scott. His book, AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief, and it truly is. Don, you hang on. We've just got a couple of minutes before we let you get to bed up there.
All right, thank you.
Well, Don, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. I want to start the wind-up by saying thank you very much for making your program available to the world. You share many, many truths that people would just as soon not hear, but there are truths that come about because they surrender their political clout to figures in the darkness who want to limit the world's population growth and other things like that. And by you at least making available to some of the people of the world some of these realities, your role is very, very important, and I very much appreciate it. I also want to conclude by indicating that none of us are exempt from the problems that these powers exert in the world. One way that they exert that power is the bio-research that's done to develop the AIDS cofactors and chronic fatigue and so on, and hence increase the amount of cancers. Another thing is to alert populations to future disasters. Now, there are going to be other disasters. One that we suspect is coming is the avian flu disaster. They've been doing a lot of drumbeating about that, but it's so that they can say afterwards, well, look, we told you it was going to happen. But the same people who were involved in developing the AIDS cofactors are involved in the research into avian flu. So all of these factors contribute to destroying lives, limiting the happiness of families, limiting economic resource development, and so on. And the only thing that can correct it is knowing the truth. Know the truth. And we spent several years from 1996. I began my research when I was 71 years old because a lady with chronic fatigue asked for help. I've never, ever looked back. It's taken every day of my life, anywhere from 1 hour to 12 hours a day and even more, but it has been worth it. Humanity needs it.
Well, I'm so glad that you have done what you've done, and certainly we need people who are willing to dedicate themselves totally to try to get the scientific truth out, and you really have. The book is excellent, Don. I want to thank you so much for writing it, and I'll really look forward to having you back with us in the not-too-distant future. God bless, and you better get to bed. It's getting late up there in Ontario, Canada.
Yeah, 1 o'clock in the morning. But thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Don Scott lives in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. Somebody had called in and asked if the vaccine that was given to the homosexuals is the same vaccine that's being given to newborns in nurseries. No. The original vaccine was made from the virus. The current hepatitis B vaccine is genetically modified. They take one gene off the rim of the virus, and they make a vaccine from that. But this is a very dangerous vaccine. You should not, under any circumstances, give it to your children, your grandchildren. First of all, there is absolutely no reason for giving it, unless, of course, the mother has hepatitis B, chronic hepatitis B. But other than that, there's absolutely no reason. This is an experiment they're doing, an expensive experiment. And, of course, the hepatitis B vaccine is the most reactive vaccine, or one of the most reactive vaccines we have. And there's so many complications. There are probably more complications associated with hepatitis B vaccine than any other vaccine, even more than in the Gardasil, which is killing young girls today, and they're selling this to them in the name of, well, now you can be as promiscuous as you want to, and of course you don't have to be worried. You can just go out and have a good time. You will not get cervical cancer from the hepatitis, human papillomavirus. Of course, it's not true. There are no studies that show that this is going to cut down in any way the incidence of cancer. All it does is change some pap smears, but we do not know how long the vaccine lasts. It's another experiment, a very costly experiment. So the hepatitis B vaccine that's given today at the newborn is unnecessary. It should not be given. It is dangerous, but it is not the same one that produced the AIDS infections in the homosexuals. That was an entirely different vaccine. Well, let me once again mention, you need to get my talk on Nundare, call it genocide, my talk on planned population reduction, and my talk on population control. Then, of course, you need to get the book, AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief, and if you want to get the very unfortunate Skull Valley incident, we carry that as well, also written by Don Scott. Fascinating work he's done. And then they have the book by Den Horowitz, which I think is excellent, Emerging Viruses. That's Emerging Viruses. We have a 4-tape set on population control. You need to have the information there. We cover why they outlawed DDT. They outlawed DDT because it was saving so many lives. It had nothing to do with the fish. It was the safest insecticide we've ever had, far safer than anything we're using today, far safer for you because you're going to get a certain amount of it. In fact, I mean, you could actually eat frank DDT and it wouldn't do you any harm. And in fact, I remember when I was in medical school, they told this story about a group of men who worked in a warehouse, and they thought this barrel was flour, so they made a cake out of DDT, and they all ate it. It was very good. If you go into the DDT factories where DDT was manufactured, the incidence of cancer was far lower than the general population. That's why they outlawed this. That, and it was saving, it had already saved probably 500 million lives. They had, of course, stopped the use of DDT. And since we've stopped its use, we've killed almost 100 million people throughout the third world, most of them children. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're up against organized evil, and to understand that, you need to hear my talk entitled The Forbidden Secret. That's The Forbidden Secret. You need to hear the talk, The Brotherhood of Darkness. You can get a book with that. You can, of course, get a syllabus with the Forbidden Secret, and then, of course, the talk on the planned police state. That's the planned police state, and we recommend that. Comes with an excellent syllabus. And, of course, if you get any of these items, we'll be glad to provide you as well. If you request it, a copy of my Population Control Agenda monograph. The Population Control Agenda monograph. It's as good as anything available any place to explain to you what really motivates these people who are so intent upon killing off most of the world's population. War is not as efficient, but of course, plague. Sweeping through the world once every generation would be our number 1-800-5-HIV, war.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation. It is, here we go, take a deep breath. It's Friday. It is the 2nd of May, 2008, and across the country, across the world, eyes are opening, ears are perking up, eyebrows are being raised, because it's true. There is a line in the sand. The question is, do you see it? Is it another Emperor's New Clothes? Where everybody knows it's there, but, oh, I don't see it, I don't see it. Well, guess what? More and more are seeing it. This is Dave.
And Joyce, boy, we have some interesting news today that is not just your run-of-the-mill news, but it's very, very surprising. I am. It's unfortunate that we have to tell you that it appears that one of the clients of a former guest on this program was found